Good morning.
I'm going to turn it on. There's a switch right up there.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's not working here. Can you hear me?
Speak up.
Just check it.
Speak up? Me?
That's it.
Good morning. The rabbi runs the microphone too. I'm Mark Crewman, and I want to welcome you to Both Sides series. I want to thank, first of all, my co-conspirator, Dolores Galea, for her organizing the series this fall. And the turnout just keeps growing. It's quite wonderful. And I want to thank you all for coming this morning. Please, I've been asked to ask you to fill out one of these cards. It provides us with your name and your email address. And I appreciate if you do that so that we can be in touch with you as we plan next year's events. Today, I think there's a certain irony that we call the series Both Sides now in light of the demographic shrinking of the conservative movement. A bad joke.
You're not going to ask us to comment on that.
No, I will not.
You could ask us. You could
do that. Okay, actually, that would be an interesting question. Today, our speakers are going to each talk for about 5 minutes, outlining generally the principles of Reform and Orthodox Judaism. And then we're going to open it up for discussion. Very pleased today, first of all, to introduce Rabbi Reuven Spolter, raised in Silver Springs, Maryland. Rabbi Spolter attended Yeshivat Sha'alvim in Israel for 2 years after high school. After completing a degree in computer science, he could probably run the microphones too then, from Yeshiva University's Yeshiva College, Rabbi Spolter continued his studies at Yeshiva, both at the Azrieli Graduate School for Jewish Education and Administration, and at the Rabbi Isaac Elkanan Theological Seminary, earning a master's degree in Jewish education and rabbinical ordination in 97, the master's degree in 98. Rabbi Spolter spent 3 years as rabbi of Congregation Agudas Achim of West Hartford, Connecticut, where he taught Judaic studies at the Hebrew High School of New England. Rabbi Spolter currently is the spiritual leader of Young Israel of Oak Park. He serves as a member of the Executive Committee of the Rabbinical Council of America, is a member of the Council of Orthodox Rabbis of Detroit, the Michigan Board of Rabbis, and he co-chaired the National Convention of the National Council of Young Israel. Before he gets to speak, I would also like to introduce our own rabbi. Those of you who are not at Temple during the search for the last search for rabbi that brought Rabbi Klein to Temple, and those of you who were might need a refresher. Rabbi Klein was born and grew up in Toledo, Ohio, graduating from Oberlin College in 1969, majoring in sociology and anthropology. He was ordained from the Cincinnati campus of Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion, with a Master of Hebrew Letters in 1975, and then served as assistant rabbi at Temple Israel in St. Louis, Missouri, for 3 years. Before coming to Temple Emmanuel, Rabbi Klein was rabbi of Mizpah Congregation in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and United Hebrew Congregation in Terre Haute, Indiana, while in Indiana and in Tennessee. Rabbi Klein was adjunct faculty in humanities at the Rose Holman Institute of Technology, Indiana State University, and the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, teaching courses on Genesis, Hebrew Scripture, First Century History, and New Testament. For 10 years, he served as the coach of the Rose Holman Fencing Club.
On guard.
On guard, indeed. I suspect that that training in fencing is very good preparation for being a rabbi, at least for the mental agility that's involved. Rabbi Klein and his wife Barbara have two children. Ellie directs high school programs in Wilshire Boulevard. In Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles, I'm sorry. Adam is a contract website designer, and you can get his business card from the rabbi afterwards, and a second-year law student at Emory University in Atlanta. This is very exciting for me now, happily, to turn the microphone first over by previous agreement to our own rabbi, Joe Klein. Rabbi Klein.
Can we do it without the mic?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
No.
Now imagine how I feel in school every week. This is really a pleasure for me to be sitting here. Usually when Reuben and I get together, it's more private. There aren't all these people looking in. And so this is really a pleasure for us. And I'm looking forward really to an enjoyable morning. It is, I think, unfortunate that in the Jewish News promotion for this, that it was titled Reform versus Orthodox. That is nothing of the case. We thought it important to share, as our publicity said, those areas in agreeing to disagree. What are the areas in which there is agreement, and what are the areas that that we can't agree on, and how do we know the difference? Let me begin by trying to very briefly explain what I think are foundational principles of Reform Judaism. And I think that what differentiates and defines and distinguishes Reform Judaism is our understanding of the content of Revelation, and secondly, the meaning and the value of how we understand the rabbinic revolution of the first century, second century, third century. And let me just briefly get more into each one of those. I think Reform Judaism begins by declaring that there is revelation, that God has revealed a message to us. However, the specific content of the oral tradition and the written tradition, the oral Torah and the written Torah being the scrolls, the five books of the Sefer Torah, that both the oral Torah and the written Torah have passed through our communities so that whatever content was revealed to our people in our past has been passed through the community so that it is no longer divinely, 100% God's Word. Revelation, as we understand it, revelation in Torah specifically, in Hebrew Scripture more generally, and certainly in the rabbinic tradition of the last 2,000 years, has without question the breath of God. In ways that other books do not, or other traditions do not. And it is our responsibility as Reformed Jews to find within those texts and within those traditions how that breath of God manifests itself in our life. So Reformed Judaism, for the most part, Reformed Jews for the most part, do not look at the written Torah as God's perfect, absolute, divinely revealed and protected word, much less the oral tradition. The second area that I think is important to note is that as I look back at the revolution that began with Pharisaic Judaism and later in Rabbinic Judaism after the destruction of the temple in 70, the rabbis attempted to create a religious community and a religious system that was not tied, no longer tied to any vulnerable entity. And so the Judaism that was created out of the Pharisees and specifically with the rabbis is a Judaism that was formulated specifically to be adapted to the communities. That Judaism was no longer confined to a place in Jerusalem, to a specific group of deciders, namely the priests, and certainly not to a specific ritual, all of which were vulnerable, as was demonstrated in 70 with the Roman destruction. As I read the texts of the rabbis, I read them saying that Judaism needs to be able to be adopted and adapted, that we need to bring the values of our community into the system of into our faith system and into our texts, and out of that find a better way to live within the cultures in which we are residing. And that that Reform Judaism, if from my point of view, is a direct descendant of the Pharisees and the rabbis, saying that we need to find a way within our culture and society and within our Jewish tradition to find a meaningful Jewish life. And with that, I will turn it over to my friend.
First of all, I want to thank Joe for inviting me here. He didn't tell you that in our normal private meetings, he enjoys trouncing me regularly in racquetball. That's what he didn't tell you. And I must tell you, Joe, I enjoy getting trounced as well. And may that continue. It's funny that we titled this Agree to Disagree. I first have to state straight out, and people who know me know I'm a relatively straightforward person. Someone who's Orthodox does not view Reform Judaism as a legitimate stream of Judaism. And I think that's important to state, that we view Orthodoxy as the true form of Judaism and really as the only legitimate form of Judaism. And it is not that we delegitimize Reform Jews. I have a love for every Jew. I have a love for every human being created in the spirit of man. But understand at the same time that we have to protect. I feel it's my duty and my responsibility to protect the tradition in which I was raised and educated. So that being said, I also want to say that it's interesting how much we agree upon. So we believe in the revelation. I believe that there was a revelation. The Jews stood around Mount Sinai, and God transmitted a Torah to Moses on top of Mount Sinai. That I believe in. I believe that with all of my heart, very, very strongly. So let's just give a theoretical example, one specific example. So God said to Moses on Sinai, Jews, you have to keep the Shabbat. It says, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho. We read that in the Ten Commandments. So that's in the written tradition. So now let me ask you, what does it mean to keep the Shabbat? That's basically pretty much all it says in the Torah about keeping Shabbos. So how am I supposed to know what does it mean to keep Shabbat? It also says in one other place in the Torah, you can't burn fires on Shabbos. But we can't do a lot more things than that. So we believe that in addition to the written Torah that God gave to Moshe and God gave to the Jewish people throughout the period of the 40 years, in addition there was an oral tradition. There was a written tradition and an oral tradition that went along with it. For example, I'll just give an extrapolated example. Well, how many of you have a VCR? Okay. How many of you received the instruction manual that came with it? How many of you understood it? So all the hands went up. Okay, well, a couple of people understood.
And how many use it?
How many use it, right. So there's a written tradition, but then you have to have your 14-year-old come and give you the oral tradition of how to actually program the thing. So along with the written tradition, with God's written word, came an oral tradition. What does it mean to keep Shabbos? What's the definition of work? Is it going to the office, being paid, or is it something else entirely? How do we define those things? So that was the oral tradition. And throughout history, the oral tradition has played an incredibly important role in defining what Judaism is. Moreover, I'll take it one step farther. Orthodox Jews believe that the oral tradition wasn't some inflexible unbending tradition, but rather it was a rabbinic Judaism. It was placed in the hands of the rabbis to shape and to mold and to define what was the divine will. It's a very, very interesting thing, a very, very important thing, that the rabbis really were given a great deal of flexibility in defining, within obviously certain parameters, what is the oral Jewish tradition. And that's a tradition that has been followed for thousands of years, literally. Now, Rabbi Klein spoke about what happened after the destruction of the temple and the beginnings of rabbinic Judaism. I disagree. I think that before there were quote-unquote rabbis, there were prophets and Jewish leaders that were always interpreting. There were shoftim, as we know. There were prophets and judges that were always interpreting the oral tradition for the Jewish people. They just didn't call them rabbis. So throughout Jewish history, for the past 3,500 years, there have been people that have been interpreting and delivering the oral tradition to the Jewish people. That has gone on before the destruction of the temple, after the destruction of the temple, and continues to this very day. And it's something that I try to do as an Orthodox rabbi, to communicate the oral tradition as it was given from Moses and passed down from generation to generation in an unbroken chain for the past 3,500 years. Now, the way I view it, Reform Judaism came along at the end of the 18th century and said, that doesn't speak to us in today's day and age. So therefore, we have to sort of develop our own mode of Judaism that speaks to us more strongly and reflects the values of the time. Now, if you study Reform Judaism carefully, you'll notice Reform Judaism has shifted a great deal from the late 18th, 19th century to the beginnings of the 20th century, and even now to the 21st century. For example, in Europe, much of Reform Judaism reflected very much the Christianity of the time in Europe, in Western Europe. There was a time once that if you were a Reform Jew, you were not permitted to wear a yarmulke in many, many synagogues. Now, thank God, it's come back the other way around. And, you know, I have to tell you very honestly, I came here, it was a Friday night, we were meeting a few people for a Friday night dinner, and they had come here for a shulchro. Was it a Yad shulchro? And Rabbi Klein was leading an outside service. You remember I showed up, mm-hmm. right? And I came at the end of Maariv, and I was surprised, very pleasantly so, how much of the Maariv here reflected the Maariv in my Orthodox shul. It was Shema, and the Shemona Esrei, and the Kaddish, and the Kiddush. And I was very surprised. But it's interesting how Reform Judaism now is sort of coming back to more traditional modes. And all I'll say is, we've been doing it all along.
Let me take it.
Questions? And please be patient with me. You don't have to be patient with the speakers. Me, you have to be patient with. Yes. Please stand up when you speak. Speak loudly.
Do I have to stand up?
Yes. Stand up. No. Stand up.
Okay, I'm a member here at Temple Emmanuel, and as a Reform Jew with Orthodox roots and Orthodox and Lubavitch connections in my personal life, I have a great deal of respect for Orthodoxy. However, I have a real hard time as a woman and a feminist, which is also part of the way, you know, I was raised and coming up with separate seating, the 15th century knew this was probably going to come up.
No, I'm shocked.
I mean, we've even gone to Mishkan Israel, and I passed it up upstairs. And some days I mind more than others. It depends what the situation of the occasion is. But I'm not going to be rude in somebody else's house of worship, because that just is not who I am. However, I have a hard time with that. I've heard in Orthodox people explain this to me, the women are insulted and all that. I just don't buy it from what I see. So it's really hard for me to reconcile all that. I wish I could be Orthodox, but I can't, because that is in the way, it's greatly in the way for me. So I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit. Or a lot.
Sure. You know, we have a joke in the Orthodox world that in my household, I make all the important decisions. What to have for dinner, whether we're going to go see a movie or not, things of that nature. My wife makes all the unimportant decisions. Where to send our kids to school, how we raise our children, all of those unimportant decisions. And to be honest with you, someone who grows up in an Orthodox home knows just how true this is. It is absolutely true that the woman runs the Orthodox home. And I think if you, especially if you have Orthodox roots, you'll know that the whole tone of the home really lies with the Jewish woman. So I believe, and I think that it's important that this is reflected in the synagogue, I don't believe that my wife is any less important than I am. In fact, I think she's much, much more important. For example, you know, you'll wish me a mazel tov. My brother is getting married in 2 weeks. Mazel tov. I am one of 7 children. My father passed away when I was 9 years old. I was the 4th of 7 children. We were ages 16 to age 2. Yeah. And now my mother is marrying off her last child. And every single one of us is religious and Orthodox and devoted to the Jewish people.
And the door of our door.
The door of our door. And that's a testament to her. And I'll say that straight out. It's a testament to her strength and her dedication to us and to our commitment to Judaism. I don't know if my father would have pulled that off. I don't know if I can pull that off. But that goes to the role of the Jewish mother in Judaism. So now what happens when the values of a society you're in conflict with the values that Judaism preaches and pronounces? I'll explain. In Judaism, there are two ways to relate to the outside. Men and women, I believe men and women are not one who's more important than the other, but they're different. They're made for different things and they have different roles. The men, we like to get up there and, you know, we're sitting here talking and we're very important. We have a much more public, pronounced role. Whereas I believe that a woman's role as a nurturer, and I believe that that's the way women are created, as a nurturer, as a mother, as a caregiver, they are women, they have the role inside of the home. Now it just so happens that we live in a society that does not value that home role. It does not. When you read someone's CV, you don't say, she is a homemaker, she has raised 4 wonderful children, she works hard in order to provide for her children. They don't say that because we don't value that. I value that. I make a very important point. When I meet a woman, I say, do you work outside of the home? Because raising a family is a full-time job. And I think every woman would acknowledge that. I think that that's something important. It's important for us to realize. So while I might have my role outside of the home, I have to go, you know, I do see that as my responsibility to make the money and provide for the home, etc. If my wife wasn't at home raising my children, what would my money be worth? So therefore, Judaism believes that not women and men are one's more important than the other, but that their roles are different. That a man's role is much more outward, out in front of the world, out there, it's a more public role, and a woman's role is more private, more nurturing, more caregiving, and more focused on inside of the home. So that manifests itself in the synagogue. In the synagogue, who leads? It's a very public role. Who has to dive in? And it's interesting. Why do men in Orthodoxy count for a minyan? There's one very simple reason. Because the men have to be there. Now you'll ask me, how come every man isn't there every morning? That's a problem that I have to deal with. That's my problem. But the women, my wife's responsibility is to take care of my children's needs, take care of her children's needs, to take care of our family's needs. And if she had to run off to minyan every day, so who would take care of the family? Who would take care of our needs? And I think that there's no shame. I think there's great pride. And she takes great pride in having that role and caring for our children. You know, she says, it's a great trade-off. She says, you know, I have a responsibility, halakhically, an obligation to be at minyan every day. And I take that responsibility very seriously. So she said she would never trade the ability to be in a minyan for the obligation to have to get up at 6:45, 6:30 every morning. She likes her role. She's very happy in it. And you'll very often find this, that women in Orthodox families are very happy with their role. They don't see themselves, I think I'm correct, your family, your relatives, they don't see themselves as missing something. So what you have here is a conflict. America does not value women nurturing in the home. It just does not. You don't see any news stories about a woman who has succeeded in raising her children. It values women who are out there, who are CEOs, who have accomplished. It devalues women who give up, who sacrifice their ability to do out in the outside world for their families. On the other hand, Orthodoxy does exactly the opposite. We very, very much value women who focus on their homes, who raise their children. They might not receive fanfare, they might not be honored at dinners, and they might not get public accolades, but they're valued more than anything, more than the men themselves.
Rabbi Klein.
You want to say something?
I'm
behind you. Okay.
Would you address questions of Reform Judaism and the relations of the sexes?
I don't know that there's anything specific that I can add to Rabbi Spelter. The Reform movement, as I said before, believes that our roles in life, our roles in society, need to express both Jewish content and the norms of social custom. Torah declares that it's all right for a man to have many wives. When society decided that that wasn't such a good thing, rabbinic tradition issued a temporary restraining order on that law, forbidding a man to have more than one wife. In the same way, I would look at the social values that are part of our culture today, certainly different than 80 years ago, 100 years ago, with the role of women. And the Reform movement strives purposefully to bring the values of the culture into our Jewish tradition. And so today, within the Reform movement, there clearly is no distinction in any way. The rabbi of Temple Emmanuel could just as easily be a woman speaking to you as me.
I have something to comment about that. There's only one problem when you try to inculcate values of the time into your religion. My religion is eternal. It goes over many generations and many different systems and many different values. So what might be a value today in American society, tomorrow you'll find won't be a value. So all of a sudden you're telling me, well, that which was my religion 20 years ago, all of a sudden isn't my religion anymore? That which was eternal 20 years ago, all of a sudden is not? And the answer is, well, yeah, Reform Judaism has the flexibility to decide and to adapt to society. A very good example of this is the way we relate to homosexuality. In the Torah, it does say that homosexuality is a sin. It is a sinful behavior. And while I have great sympathy for people who have a predilection towards this behavior, nonetheless, it is sinful. And it is not something that because society says is acceptable, I can go ahead and say I therefore accept. Because I'm bound by a divine tradition, by a timeless tradition. And if in 20 years the world turns around and says we've decided that homosexuality is now sinful, that's great for the world. But I'm still bound to my tradition, to my Torah. And I think that that's something that we have to remain cognizant of. If something is so flexible that it adapts to whatever society is going to tell it, how meaningful could it really be?
And what would you tell a gay person who comes to you?
What would I tell someone who's homosexual comes to me? I would say to them that just as anyone who has a predilection towards sinful behavior has to struggle with that, I don't believe that it's genetic. I believe that it's both genetic, but it's also a behavior. For example, what would I tell somebody who says, listen, Rabbi, I'm engaged in an extramarital affair with a married woman. I fell in love with her and I have to follow through on it. So would you say, well, then that's okay? No, that's not okay. That's a sin. In the same way, someone who has a predilection towards a sinful behavior, you have to greet them with sympathy, with a great deal of compassion, and say, I would like to help you deal with this, but at the same time, I can't justify your behavior as a lifestyle when I believe that it's sinful.
Rabbi, you want to talk about homosexuality?
Yeah. if we just keep this between us.
Yeah,
okay.
You may not get to ask questions.
I think that there is there are clearly values that transcend anybody's understanding of Torah. And when we read in Torah in chapter 1 that humanity was created in God's image, God created us to be like God, that there is value in every human life. The Midrash talks about every human life is worth the life of the whole world. Our tradition is shot through with the basic integrity of humanity. And yes, that there is behavior that is wrong, and then there is behavior that is right, and Torah tries to direct us to right and to wrong behavior.
And my disagreement is that, I don't see homosexuality as a sinful behavior. I try with everything I do to look for the divine in all people, to see the reflection of God in all people. And when I read that section in Leviticus, for instance, that talks about male homosexuality, not about female homosexuality, I don't read it at all as the abomination that it states it is. I mean, clearly Leviticus says male homosexuality is an abomination. But when you look at that whole section, and again, it's how what values are we bringing to Torah? When I read that section in Leviticus, I read a section of statements against doing what other nations are doing. A list of abominations in which male homosexuality is one of those. And so the value that I see presented in that section of Leviticus is that we should not be doing what other peoples are doing just because they need to be doing it. It is not necessarily a divine indictment of homosexual behavior. You want a pen?
Yeah.
I see Torah as reflecting its time, and there are we could list the values that Torah presents that certainly we don't follow. You know, we don't stone our rebellious sons in the public square, among other things. If I am coming to Torah trying to find God's breath within its text, there are some places in Torah that I don't see God's breath, and I am not, and I don't feel compelled to accept it at its face value.
Before we get to questions, come on. Rabbi Klein just said, we shouldn't be doing what other people are doing just because they're doing it. I wrote that down. But 5 minutes ago he said, we tried to inculcate the values of society into our religious view, which means we're doing what other people are doing because they're doing it. So it seems to be somewhat contradictory. What's that?
Okay.
The values. Okay. My other response, meaning, when do you decide what value is appropriate and what value is not? If Leviticus was just saying, do not inculcate the values of the nations in which you are going to be living because you have a divine commandment to do what you're supposed to be doing, shouldn't that apply in the United States of America as well? At the same time, if you're going to read Leviticus and say, well, I'm going to read that away and that doesn't really apply to me today because it's got a different application and it's just the nations of the time, first of all, that's not true, because if there was homosexuality and bestiality in Mesopotamia or Canaan at the times of the Jewish people entering from the desert, all you got to do is look at the World Wide Web to know that those things exist today as well. If you're going to decide, pick and choose, what from Leviticus is divine and what is not, this speaks to me and that doesn't speak to me, then in reality, none of it is really divine, because you can pick and choose.
How does the reform?
You're going to have to also speak to the crowd.
All right, I'll try. How does the reform? I got a birdie. Oh, I'm sorry. How does the reform movement vary and differ from the Karaites? And then reference to Rabbi Spolzer, Jewish women, Orthodox women. In the secular world, are very highly educated. Many are today graduates of Yeshiva University. Yeshiva University is listed in the last rating of universities, around number 41. The University of Michigan is number 25. Michigan State University is number 73. The girls who come out of Yeshiva U, 98% of them get accepted to the professional or graduate program of their first choice. Jewish Orthodox women are well educated and they know the role in Judaism. Second of all, the leading theologian at the conservative movement was Rabbi Saul Lieberman, correct?
Yeah.
So, and I'm using it from the conservative. I don't want to use the Orthodox. He said that men and women sitting together without a machitza is a grave break in Jewish tradition and Jewish law. He would not, at the theological seminary, daven in a mixed sanctuary. This does not degrade the women from not being on both sides. It's a matter of, this is Judaism. What you're really hearing expressed here is a concept of a form of assimilation. You know, if you go to Europe, many bathrooms are joint for males and females. You don't have that here. And you get told that that occurred here.
Your
but
question,
it does occur in Europe.
Your question to the rabbis?
Well, my question was to Rabbi.
Okay.
And to Rabbi Spolter, will you daven in this institution on the Shabbos and according to the format of Reform Movement's prayer system? Question to both of you.
The Karaites rejected the ultimate rabbinic revolution that began with Pharisees. The Karaites rejected the whole notion of the oral tradition. No, I don't think that Reform Judaism is Karaite Judaism at all. I look at the rabbinic tradition that goes back 2,000 plus years, and I find tremendous value in the process, in the discussion, in the decisions. And besides, there is no Karaite Judaism anymore, except for a few congregations in California.
The question was, would I daven in this synagogue? The answer is no.
Hi, I'm Mike Strecker, a member of Temple Emmanuel, and my question is for Rabbi Spolter. It has to do with Israel, to change the subject. Sharon has spoken of painful compromises that might have to be made, and if the settlements on the West Bank and in Gaza have to be dismantled, my impression is that many in the Orthodox community would find it not just very difficult, as many of us would, but it would be religiously a sin. So I'd like you to address that. The line between politics and religion in an issue like that.
The question is, would it be sinful, what I could consider it sinful, to give up and dismantle settlements in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip? The answer, I got to tell you, I don't know. I'm not a general. And there are greater people than me that can answer this question. Of course, I think all of us should feel great connection to many of these settlements in the Gaza Strip, as we call it, the West Bank. People think of it as, you know, some evil place that some of these quote-unquote settlers are living. I was in a town called Elon Moreh. Do you know where Elon Moreh is first mentioned? Elon Moreh is first mentioned as the first place that Abraham Avinu, so many thousands of years ago, laid eyes upon the land of Canaan. Today it's a Jewish settlement overlooking the city of Shechem. The Arabs call it Nablus. So now you're telling me because somebody drew a line on a map in 1948 that I'm not supposed to have a connection to the land which Abraham Avinu settled upon so many thousands of years ago? I'm not supposed to have a connection to Hebron, where our forefathers are buried? This week's Parsha, we read about the burial of Rachel. She was buried in Beit Lechem. Beit Lechem is on the wrong side of the map. I'm not supposed to feel connected to that land. Every one of us here, Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, every Jew should feel connection to that land, because that is our heritage, our birthplace, and our right. And I think that that's something that all of us have to feel connected to. Now, you'll ask me the question, what about Jewish lives? What about bringing about peace? Then you have to ask a general, and you have to ask a great rabbi. General, would it save Jewish lives? And Rabbi, what's worth fighting for? So those are questions that people greater than me would have to answer. But I think that when we come to the holiness of the land of Israel, it isn't just Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and Haifa. Look at the Bible. I encourage every one of you, make the effort when you go to Israel, take the tour. They call the land of Yehuda and Shomron, Judea and Samaria, it's called Eretz HaTanach, the land of the Bible, because every page has some place that's a hill in the land of Judea and Samaria. And I would cry, really cry, if we would have to give up 1 inch of that land.
Rabbi Klein?
Okay. Good statement.
I'm concerned about the surrounding cultures or anything, but right here in the
and I agree that the mother's role is important, but at 8 to 12, you're not a mother. When the children are grown, you're not raising them. I see in Colombo that where men are concerned, all kinds of efforts are taken. For instance, the 70-year-old deaths are supposed to be canceled, and it was reinterpreted, not canceled, but postponed. If there's a danger that a man will be deprived of marriage with his companionship and sexual satisfaction, then they'll get 100 rabbis to condemn that. But when it comes to women, a woman can be a celibate for life, and the rabbis are still crying and doing nothing. A woman can suffer a lot of barrenness, which means she ovulates before she goes to the mikvah, and nothing is done about it. So I'm going to ask you, is God deciding this for the rest?
I'm going to respond by first of all saying that there are oftentimes very painful situations about which I can do nothing other than cry. And it happens quite a bit. I think that there's a misconception that rabbis don't care about women. Now, one thing she mentioned is a crisis called the Agunah crisis. So there's a halakha that says when a man marries a woman, the man, this is written in the Torah, the Kasha of Life, Sefer Kritus, the Torah says that in order to initiate a divorce, the man must divorce the woman. That's the way the Torah writes it. And we can discuss theology about why that is and how that is. But that's the Torah. That's what the Torah says. Now, first of all, I will say the following. When a woman marries a man, she has to have a very great deal of confidence that when she places her life in his hands, that she trusts him. She has to know that when she marries him, the only way she can become unmarried is if he divorces her. Because those are the rules. That's the way the Torah defines marriage and divorce. That's the Torah definition. I think that that's important to say. The second thing is, as a rabbi, I don't have control over people. So if someone comes to me and says, Rabbi, my husband refuses to grant me a divorce. I have community pressure. I have sometimes monetary pressure. But I can't solve the world's problems, and I can't solve the problem that this guy is a jerk. And if I exert every pressure I have, and if I exert every ability that I have, and he still says, Rabbi, I don't care. I want to hurt my wife, and I'm not going to give her a divorce forever. What can I do about the fact that he's a low-life scumbag? What can I do? How do I have pressure? I can't change the rules. So nowadays, hold on a second. Nowadays, the Rabbinical Council of America realized that as we're progressing in the world, great, and men are sometimes exerting this pressure, using this ability. So there is something that we can do. What can we do? We can establish what's called a prenuptial agreement, a civil prenuptial agreement. The prenuptial agreement states the following. The man and the woman agree. This is in the Orthodox community. The man and the woman agree that if they become separated and engage in a civil divorce, the man promises that he will pay the woman a certain amount of money until such time as he grants her a Jewish divorce as well. So every day, they write down $100 or whatever, every day that he doesn't give her a Jewish divorce, he owes her $100 to support her. So now, over time, if he's Donald Trump, then he might not care. But most people will probably care and pay $35,000 a year so as not to give their wife a Jewish divorce. And I want you to know that I do not perform a marriage unless they have taken out a prenuptial agreement that is endorsed by the Rabbinical Council of America. That I can do. So that I do, and I insist upon it. But I can't solve the world's problems. I can't tell people not to be jerks. I can tell them to, but they don't have to necessarily listen to me. Now, in the times we had enforceable courts, for example, Maimonides writes that the courts had the right to beat him. They say, Kofin oto atziyoma rosa ani. The court had the right to beat him to a pulp until he said, no, I want to give her a divorce. So, I don't have that ability anymore. If you would give me that ability, believe me, I would use it. But I don't have it. And the fact that a person abuses a system doesn't make the system wrong, it makes a person wrong. And we can't blame. Very often, people use the legal system, the American legal system, to abuse the government, to cheat from the government, to find tax loopholes. Are you going to tell me the system's wrong? Sometimes it is, but sometimes people are thieves. And you can't blame the system on the corruption of the individual.
Do you have more time?
Well, I think that this, in fact, does suggest some consideration in terms of flexibility.
Okay, it's always refreshing to me to see the traditional Jewish community look upon changing standards and recognize that they need to do something in order to reflect what clearly are positive and meaningful social values. The insistence on a civil agreement that the woman could take to any court, that's the power of it. It's not a religious power.
Civil court.
That you take to civil court and enforce the $100 a day. I think that that's a wonderful statement. What is encouraging is that it is slowly happening within traditional Judaism. My problem is that it's not happening quickly enough. It's why Reform Judaism sets itself up differently and is better able and more quickly able to make those adjustments. Always preserving the values, I think, of Jewish tradition. I mean, the value of the prenuptial is that people need to be helped. We need to preserve and protect the well-being of people. That's the value. And I think that's wonderful. It would be nice if it was more universal.
True. True.
A little bit louder. I'd like you to distinguish between your comment that the form, this form back to a bit, but it's sort of general, but it's just answer the question. How do you distinguish between your thinking and choosing the notion of conformity, to sort of building off of what Joseph's been asking, and your thinking and choosing, since both are based on rabbinic discourse and interpretation, and building on that, you would answer that question rather than saying we're picking and choosing, you're not, other than you know you're right. Okay. Particularly since within the Orthodox, there are various interpretations on what is essential and what is not among yourselves. So please comment on that.
A loaded question.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree that we're picking and choosing. I am bound by the tradition as it's defined by the rabbis that preceded me. Bound. So therefore, I don't have the right to pick and choose and say, what do I accept or what don't I accept? I believe that it's an ongoing tradition, a revelation, a communication from generation to generation. What we call the Mesorah. The Mesorah means to pass over, to pass on. And I'm bound by the rabbis that came before me. I don't have the right to reinterpret and say, well, the value of Shabbat is that I rest. So as long as I'm on the golf course and I feel rested, therefore, that's a Shabbat value. The value of Shabbat is defined by the rituals which God has sort of set out for us. And the rabbis have the right to establish parameters of what falls in accepted ritual, what falls within accepted prohibition, what does not. And I'm bound by the definitions of those rituals as they're passed over to me. So, for example, when it comes to divorce, yes, there is a value in protecting the woman. In fact, you'll notice at every wedding, I think even at Reform weddings, they have a ketubah. Do they have a ketubah at a Reform wedding too? Why? Because the rabbis, thousands of years ago, felt the need to protect the interests of a woman. Now, this is very interesting. They'll never translate. You ever notice they read the ketubah at the wedding and they don't translate it? You ever wonder what it says in a ketubah? What it says in the ketubah is, if I divorce you or I die, I will pay you or my estate will pay you such and such amount of money. That's what it says. Pretty formulaic and it's pretty dry and not romantic whatsoever. There's no mention of love or caring or, I will cherish you and I will protect you.
It looks pretty.
It looks nice, right? You know, I always noticed that was beautiful. They always read it out beautifully and just, It's a legal document. It's a prenuptial. That's basically what it is. Nothing more. But the Torah has established the ritual that's required in order to enact a Jewish divorce. The man has to divorce the woman. He has to give her what's called a get. So if the Reform want to uphold that value and say, well, then the woman can initiate a get and give a divorce to a man, that's beyond the parameters of the definition of Judaism that was established by the rabbis. And according to Jewish tradition, that couple, albeit living separately, is still halachically married. And it's important to realize that. I think that if a person engages in a Reform divorce without the right of a get, according to Jewish tradition, they are still married. and then may not remarry in the Orthodox tradition.
You know, it brings up something that I raised at the very beginning, and that's this notion of revelation. And I truly believe that the key to understanding what differentiates us is that notion of revelation. If I look at Torah, both written and oral, as having God's breath in it, I am clearly saying not.